Welcome to The Academic Citizen, a podcast about critical issues in higher education.
The podcast is sponsored by ASAWU, the Academic Staff Association of Wits University, based in Johannesburg, South Africa.
Our podcast explores a wide variety of issues about university life relevant to staff and students, looking at issues in South Africa, Africa, and beyond.
In each episode, we speak to a guest who has special insight or expertise in a particular subject, and we also bring in student voices linked to that theme.
My name is Nosipho Mgomezulu.
And my name is Mahita Ikani.
And we're your hosts.
My name is Kevia Cardoso. I'm studying journalism at Wits. I think it's high time that languages, South African languages, are incorporated into the academic sphere. I think it needs to be something implemented by the university itself and encouraged. And in this instance, it seems to be somebody has taken their own initiative and done it themselves. And there's a lot of challenges to that, and it doesn't seem like the kind of thing that's nurtured and fostered in academic institutions, so it actually takes courage. And so I admire him, and I think we're going to see a lot of it in the upcoming years, and it just takes somebody like this to take the first step.
On today's episode of The Academic Citizen, we talked to Dr. Hleze Kunje, who is currently a lecturer at the Sol Plaatje University in the Northwest. Dr. Kunje wrote his four-year-long PhD thesis about amaXhosa who settled in Mbembezi, about 45 kilometers outside of Bulawayo in Zimbabwe. He graduated with his PhD in April 2017, making him the first doctoral thesis written isiXhosa to graduate from the university currently known as Rhodes. Welcome to the show, Hleze.
Thank you, Susan. Thank you.
Thank you so much for making time to chat with us. Hleze, I remember in my youth in Grahamstown, going to watch your performances and hearing about the amazing work that you are doing. And the first thing I want to really ask you about is your personal journey. How did you get to where you are now? Can you tell us a little bit about your personal story?
I mean, I love the art and languages. That's all I know, art and languages. That's all I've always wanted to, you know, since growing up, I always sang at a choir, community choir, sang at church and all those things. And also growing up, in being born in rural areas, Mkanduli and Ngwaha, when I did my schooling, you know, very close, it's a closer area. Everything is done in isiXhosa. Even at school, you're taught in isiXhosa. All subjects taught in isiXhosa, including isiNgesi, is taught in isiXhosa. So I think I grew up enjoying, you know, that, you know, it is more about Xhosa. I think that's how I got to love isiXhosa. I got to love ubuXhosa and amaXhosa. So, and then I went to Rhodes after I finished my high school, and then majored in isiXhosa, drama and music. And of course, because I was involved in those, doing those subjects, so I was involved in all the activities that had to do with those subjects. So drama, I'd be involved in a lot of dramas and involved in opera companies and singing and choirs and so on. And also involved in poetry circles and doing poetry workshops and all that. So that's what I've been sort of been doing since, growing up and at Rhodes. And I'm still doing that even now.
And I mean, I'm familiar with umsebenzi wakho, that performing operas and doing poetry. The opera element, I'm curious about. Ukuthi wangena kanjani in this kind of classical music that a lot of people often find, ukuthi this is a very intimidating foreign language?
I would say, you know, after, you know, during the apartheid with Group Areas Act and so on, you know, there were things that were meant for white people only, you know, and universities meant for white people only. And it was at those universities that they would offer, you know, classical studies and classical opera music and so on. But after 1994, I mean, it was now, you could go to any university where you wanted to. So a lot of black people got exposed to, you know, classical music and opera music and so on. And we fell in love with it, you know, the style of music. But I think in the process of falling in love with it, we also, you know, as much as we enjoyed it, we thought, maybe we should try and do this in our own languages and so on. So Actually, my master's research was just on that, on how on the Africanization of opera music. So we started having, you know, I don't know if you're familiar with Princess Magogo, the opera, which was done by Opera Africa in Isizulu.
And Isitosa
did a couple of those as well. Inkosana Yenyanga, the Moon Prince, Themba Noseliba, and so on. So this is opera music at the Western style, Western frame, you know, the... You've got your overture, you've got your arias, you've got your duets, you've got your recitatives, and so on. But you do those in our own African languages and telling our own stories. So I think that made opera even more enjoyable. So we learned it, see how it's done, and then we Africanized it, you know, did it in our own way. So that's how I fell in love with opera music. And I mean, I fell in love with the opera music itself and then also enjoyed the Africanization of it. And something I did my master's research around that. So also it's part of the mission of African languages to show that African languages can do exactly what other languages can do what Italian can do what German and other languages can do. So even now for festival, I've got a show singing Broadway for the National Arts Festival.
Oh, wow.
Performing. And also, you know, some doing some songs in isiXhosa to show that, in, and also using multilingual, you know, switching from Italian to isiXhosa and so on, just to prove and show that people, you know, the languages, our African languages are capable of doing anything that any language can do. So shouldn't categorize our languages as, you know, this is better, this is better, this can do this and this can't do. There's no such thing as, you know, we can do whatever we want to do in our own languages. And it's our responsibility to, you know, show those, develop the material and present it to the world to see.
That's so important. The fact that you've got these multidisciplinary influence in both the arts and also within literature, I think makes for a very rich way of engaging with languages, because we are pushing Uguti, we're codifying African languages, we're writing dictionaries, we're doing a lot of translation work. But I think the fact that you engage Ama'ats in doing this, it actually shows us the ways in which we experience language, not just only as a textual form, but also part of performance.
Definitely the point, you know, we're trying to make about that. You know, and just to also inspire, you know, show people that this is not about an individual person. I mean, if we make these things and make them individual things and say this is Hleze's thing and this is, we will never move forward. You know, we need to understand this is, there's no individual here. This is everyone. Everyone has a part to play. So we must all play our part. Because if we make it an individual thing, it will be very hard to develop. So we shouldn't wait for another thesis or whatever somewhere else. You should do whatever you can do where you are, you know, because I feel like people like Prof. Nguki Wasiyongwa has been, you know, talking about this for decades. And I think as Africans, we've made it Prof. Nguki's thing, you know, instead of our own thing. I mean, we've read Decolonization of the Mind for many times. We know, but we're not, you know, doing much because we sort of make it an individual thing, Prof. Nguki's thing. And, you know, I mean, of course, it has happened there, but I mean, if people, you know, we take this as our own thing, as Africans, and understand and move forward, I think we'll have more impact. You know, I always make examples about the Chinese. You know, when you hear things about the Chinese study, they talk about Chinese study, they don't mention the name specifically about the individual who did the Chinese study or whatever. Mm. You know, it's a Chinese study, it's a German class, it's all these things. So I think as Africans as well, we need to move into that, you know, owning everything. So this is the first thesis at Rhodes. It's not thesis, it's Amaxhosa thesis, it's African people. This is, you know, African people now can produce, you know, it must be known that African people can, and Amaxhosa can produce material or academic knowledge in their African languages. So, you know, I'm just trying to, you know, because once we individualize and say this is Hleze, now we're going to wait for another Hleze and another Hleze instead of, you know, working together as Africans and just move forward. Each and every single one of us playing our part, you know, I think that's the point I just tried to make.
And ibalulekile lento oyishoyo ukuthi ubuntu kahle kahle, because the act of opening up the doors for other people, not only to stand at the podium.
Yes, umuntu ngumuntu ngabantu. What I did it because of the support from other people. So why now when I get it now, it's a Hleze thing, it's a Hleze did this and that. No, I didn't do that. It's because of, you know, the nurturing I got from growing up, being taught in isiXhosa and all that, all the love. So umuntu ngabantu. So, and when umuntu achieves something, it's not umuntu's thing, it must be an abantu thing, you know, everyone's success. And And just, we need to just all keep working and working together as well.
And Bengfunukuza, about the role of mentorship. So we know that many of historically white institutions, and even at historically black institutions, kukhona the opportunity to be able to conduct research in African languages. But often what people talk about is that there's a dearth of mentorship. Can you tell us a little more about your own experience with being mentored into African languages and being encouraged, and how you were encouraged to take it up not only as an undergraduate level but to continue up to postgrad level?
Yes. Okay. I didn't really, you know, have a specific mentor sort of guided me and encouraged me. It was just more of it was everyone, you know. It was my life. I mean, let me say all the Xhosa people mentored me, you know, because I just love Xhosa and love Xhosa and the culture and all that. So that's what motivated me. And also being at, you know, when I got to high school, I did understand. I mean, I did get to see that, you know, there's so much negativity towards Xhosa. You know, even though all of us are Xhosa, but, you know, when it came to maybe doing English exams or oral exams in English, you know, everyone made a big deal. But when it was time for isiXhosa, you know, it was very, even the teachers themselves, you could see they're not putting the same effort they put for other, you know, subjects, especially English. And that also sort of bothered me at the back of my mind, but why, I think it was sort of some sort of fear, because I thought, wow, this is all I know, and now why will I send up Puma as close as name the Shibu Xhosa Ram and then Young Yena with Singes and so on. I think that scared me a bit, and I always wanted to hold on to Xhosa Ram. So, and also became a teacher later on, is a Xhosa teacher in high school, and also it was still the same thing. When it's time for English and other things, you know, people work very hard and all that. When it's times for my period, because you can see the atmosphere changes. And I always wanted to change that, you know, and prove to people that, you know, there's so much we can do with African languages, and we are the culprits, you know. Everything is up to us now, of course, with the support, you know, at some level, the support of the government and so on. But for anything to change, it has to be African people, it has to be amaXhosa or amaZulu and so on, for anything significant to happen or change in their language. We are the ones who have to do that. So I think that's what inspired me. And of course, when I got to Rhodes now, to postgrad level, I met Professor Russell Kashula, who is an isiXhosa lecturer, he's an NRF Sachi chair at the moment, which focuses on multilingualism, intellectualization of African languages and education. So he also supported me a lot. He was also the chairperson of the language committee at Rhodes, which I was part of. Which is the language committee that yagqugquzelela ukuhlaziywa kwe-language policy. So he was also, yes, was, well, yeah, so if I would have to think of a mentor, I'd have to, you know, so mention him. And of course, with Utata, Dr. Jadezwe, he was also at Rhodes University, I worked with both of them, you know, for PhD then. So those were quite strong people that I looked up to at Rhodes University.
You know, we were talking to Prof Mhlambe here at Wits a few weeks ago, actually, around the intellectualization of African languages. And I'm so glad, Uthi, you brought up multilingualism as well. Ngicela usichazele, Uthi, at Sobleki, because you're in the Northwest right now. So how do you work with multilingualism, bearing in mind, Uthi, it's not just isiXhosa nesiNgisi, but we're also engaging with Afrikaans, Tswana.
Started, you know, 2 months ago. So of course, it's just how I work. You know, I do understand we're a multicultural society, we're a multiracial society, and a multilingual society. And I've been in classes at Rhodes where I feel my language has been really totally sidelined and marginalized, and as you know, it's made to feel nothing. And when I'm in front of class, you know, I try to make sure that I don't make other people of the other languages feel the same way I felt, because it was really not a nice feeling. So when I teach things like teaching practice, and because I'm in the education department, I do teach teaching practice and other things where I teach everyone, not necessarily about isiXhosa, but, you know, other things in teaching. So I do use, I try to use other languages as much as I can. I explain something, I try to, you know, if we've got group work students, to explain things or do a project in Setswana about what we're talking about in Afrikaans and so on. And just to have such an exciting experience when you have, you know, a full lecture hall with, you know, people playing with different languages. That's really exciting. And you can see, you know, some people look a little bit, you know, like, what is happening? But you can see it's something new and it's something exciting, you know, playing with different languages and learning. What I've learned from that as well, that when I teach, I can teach in English or in Xhosa. And people say, yeah, they understand. But someone else, when they explain now in Setswana, you can see now they're on another different, higher level of understanding. And someone says something in Afrikaans, that's also the same. So it's a really exciting thing. I mean, I don't understand much of any of these languages, but the feeling that the atmosphere just changes, it's really something amazing. Slowly trying to, when I prepare my slides, you know, ask colleagues and even students themselves, put certain things in Setswana, in Afrikaans, and so on. Just to, you know, have that. So multilingualism is really important. I think it's something that needs to, you know, also go into research. As we do research as well, we need to, you know, think about that. I think it will probably be a main thing later on in South Africa. But for that to be effective and work properly, we also have to elevate our African languages. Because if now you are talking about multilingualism, you know, different languages, and there's a language that are stronger than others, it won't work. Mm. So for it to be effective, we also need to work very hard on our African languages, get them to the same level that where other languages are, in a way, specifically English and Afrikaans are, to push that by producing knowledge in our African languages and writing academic articles in our African languages and teaching in our African languages. So if we have that as a base, then multilingualism will be very effective. So at the moment, it won't be as effective as it should be if there's no equality in languages.
I think it's really fantastic, Uguti, you're working within the education space. So your pedagogy, as you're describing, it sounds like a really rich classroom environment, because that co-facilitation process, Uguti, are my students now see themselves as having valid knowledge, which I think is one of the biggest critiques we have of higher education. Uguti, people arrive, as you mentioned, into a space where they are made to feel lesser than, instead of actually bringing those experiences into the classroom and actually enriching that space. So that I think it's yet another the reason why we continuously advocate for, it's not just simply about adding for adding's sake. It's actually showing, Uguti, this diversity enriches the learning environment, as you so aptly describe in the case of your classroom. I want to move also to just asking you a bit more about your research. I know that you've been answering a lot of questions about this community, MMS. Can you tell us a little bit more about the community you worked with and how you came to this research topic?
I was a teacher teaching drama and music in Zimbabwe, Mashonaland, in a school called Peterhouse Group of Schools. And then I was once asked to do a workshop in Matabeleland, a school called Falcon. There was a choir festival or something like that. And then I met a man who introduced himself as Njof. And that was the first and last time I saw him, and that's all I remember of him in Jofu. And then he said, we're talking, he realized I was Xhosa. And then he said, you know that there are Xhosa people right here in Zimbabwe. And of course, I was very shocked by that. He said, no, there are Xhosa people, there are Xhosa schools here, there are, you know, the Xhosa culture, they practice all the Xhosa culture and everything. And I was very shocked, and I struggled to believe that. Mm. But that stayed at the back of my mind. And I remember I went back to Mashonaland, and the staff from there, and I asked teachers, and they laughed at it. Not a single teacher knew about it. They thought that was just a big joke. But he gave me directions, and then to go to this place. And I kept asking people in Zimbabwe, in Bulawayo, Matabeleland, and people didn't know about this, and they just didn't believe it. And then until I heard in the news that King Zwelonke, the king of the Xhosa people, is the first person to visit Indembezi, you know, since the 1800s and 1900s, when those people moved, they've never had any interaction with the Xhosa people in the Eastern Cape, and the king was the first person to visit there. So that was sort of a confirmation from them, like, oh, so there are actually people here. And I thought, that would have been me now if I'd, you know, moved there quickly. But straight after that, I think I was still working on my master's at the time. And then after, as soon as I finished, I went straight to the king in Mwadi, Eastern Cape, and to just ask more questions about this. And then he did say, you know, there is a group of Xhosa people in Zimbabwe who are coming from the Eastern Cape, from places like Tsomo, Ngqamakwe, Dujwa, Tuwa, Ngushwa, and so on, Tosimvama, and so on. But he also didn't have enough information on how they got there and all that. All he knew was that they are there, you know, and so on. So I gave you permission to go there myself as well, do your research. So that's how I did. So then I drove straight there, and then I went into the area, looked for the chief, and then I went to the chief, and I told him my story that I was interested in doing a research about this, because I've been doing a research, and there's nothing, I can't find anything written about them. And he gave me permission to work with them. So, and then I just worked there for the next 3 years. I was there, you know, attending functions and everything, and just looking particularly at how, because I was so impressed with the language that, you know, here we're struggling to finish one sentence without putting a English conjunction here and there or whatever. And these people have been here for 15 years at the time, and they still speak isiXhosa, and isiXhosa is not being taught in school and all that, but they still speak it. So I was interested in researching on how the language has survived for so many years and so on. So I spent those 3 years with them and just looking at that.
And I'm curious, Uguti, how has the community been able to preserve the language, and also bearing in mind Uguti ulimi liyashintsha, and so obviously isiXhosa in the Eastern Cape, isiXhosa in Cape Town. Has over the years changed. How have you found in Zimbabwe the language also evolved?
I think the fact that they're sort of a smaller group, I mean, compared to amaXhosa in the Eastern Cape, as much as they're amongst the Mandebele and the Mashona and other minority groups in Zimbabwe, but the fact that they are a smaller group in one particular place when they arrived in Zimbabwe, I think that has played a great role. So I said the land, the fact that they were given a piece of land to stay in, and stay there. So because of that land, they were able to practice their culture, you know, if it was a culture there. And you know that language and culture are things that cannot be separated. You know, we use language to express our culture and all this. So those cannot be separated. So they got to practice their culture. And then within culture, you've got all sorts of things, songs. So songs play a very big role, you know, in the African culture, because, you know, every gathering, there has to be a song. Whether it's a sad gathering or a happy gathering, there has to be a song. And in those songs, there's also history embedded in those songs as well, which, you know, plays a great role in preserving the language. And also religion. They were religious people as well. They have churches, they have Methodists, they have Anglicans, and so on. And then in those churches, they had, you know, isiXhosa Bibles and hymns in isiXhosa. So they used to get those exported from South Africa and so on. So that was, you know, for the main place, churches were the main place where they could find written isiXhosa. And they also, when they moved with those, with the South African literature classic books that were, you know, produced by Omkhayi and other people. So they had copies, those copies circulating. So, you know, when they speak in gatherings, once in a while, they quote Mkhayi here and they quote something, you know. So those books they had, and they've got knowledge about, you know, classic isiXhosa books that they've, you know, kept. And lately, technology and social media, they've got a Facebook group, they've got WhatsApp groups, and so on, where they communicate in isiXhosa. And in 2013 in Zimbabwe, the isiXhosa now is officially recognized in the Zimbabwean constitution. So I think that also boosted them a lot. And so that was, and also in 2014, they started introducing isiXhosa in their schools again. You know, now they, you know, they started teaching isiXhosa in school. So those are the things that I've, you know, sort of looked at and said, you know, these are the things that have played a big role in preserving isiXhosa in Zimbabwe.
It's so fascinating, again, referring back to my conversation with Prof. Mhlambi, that the misconception about African languages, Uguti, they are only oral, and not to actually disparage, because orality is very important. I'm curious, Uguti, you also bring up the fact that there's written, you know, there's Omkhayi, there's iBhayibheli, there's also music and then ritual, all of which inform the ways in which the language is not only preserved, but then evolves to the point where online social media. It's also part of the changing landscape of African languages.
Yes.
And I think this is such an important point. It's very rarely highlighted when we speak about African languages. We continue to look at it through these very strange eyes of looking back as if these our languages don't evolve, as if aren't constantly reflecting the times that we are in. So that's really fascinating. The textual nature is a huge part of the preservation of the language in a different context. And now, just to be an even bigger nerd, I want to get into your ethnography. I really want to know, Uti, when you are conducting this grounded research and conducting ethnography, what were some of the things that you learned about that you couldn't access through the archives, or even that weren't recorded in the archives, like in the grounded research?
Couldn't find any material or anything written about these people in archives.
Not even Le Diary of Cecil John Rhodes.
Not even there were letters that were sent between you know Rhodes and Amaxosa and South Africa and so on, and they actually signed. They call it a blue book, or something. They signed a blue book and so on. But I couldn't even find those things that they signed and all that. But one of the archaeologists said that when during the Second World War, there was a museum or archives in London that was bombed, and a lot of information. He said that it's possible that when they signed, everything was sent to London, and during the bombings in London, maybe that's where all the information disappeared. So those were just the things that I couldn't, access. And some people told me that they used to write in Isixhosa in the newspapers in Zimbabwe. And I tried to, I spent months and months, going through all the Bantu Mirrors, one of the oldest newspapers in Zimbabwe, trying to find those texts and things. But no, I couldn't find any of those. But, I got more than enough spending the 3 years with the people there recording everything. There's actually so much data that I haven't even had a chance to look at it, because there was just so much about those people. So, but I decided to just focus on the data that looked specifically on the preservation of language.
And did you find there were generational differences? Like, do the young people growing up in Zimbabwe see themselves as connected to Amaxhosa in South Africa, or is it different between the generations?
You see, now that's a very complex thing that I think it probably needs a historian, not a linguist, to do later. Because there's actually a big group called the Sojini Cultural Group that's made up of only Amaxhosa from Zimbabwe in Johannesburg. There's about 4,000 of them. So I met with the leadership on Monday, and they expressed how they feel. They feel displaced and homeless in a way. They feel they don't belong in Zimbabwe, because there's a big number of them in Zimbabwe who've never been able to get identity books, because their parents' death certificates or books are South Africans. So they're told in Zimbabwe to go there, to go get their identity books in South Africa, because they don't belong there. Hmm. And also in South Africa, it's another big challenge. They made an example about a lady who's been trying to get identity books since 1993. And even today, Home Affairs has sent out people to go investigate in the Eastern Cape about where she comes from and all that. There's a lot of paper trail on that, but she still hasn't been able to get her ID book. So it's a very complex situation, and they've been working with Home Affairs since Dr. Nkosazana Dlamini Zuma, and they even sat down with Minister Malusi Gigaba when he was at Home Affairs, trying to explain this. But also in Bembezi, the land is generally quite nice land, nice and flat and productive, So the older generation, they more they enjoy their farming, But still, not everyone, because on Sunday, another man who was 97 years old, he died on Monday. I've mentioned him in the research as well. And apparently before he died, he said he wanted to be buried at home in the Eastern Cape. And now his children, how will that be done? He doesn't have any papers that says he's from the Eastern Cape. So it's a very heartbreaking situation. I need intervention, but I don't know, where to start. But I don't even remember what the question was now. I just got...
No, I mean, it's about the grounded research. And what really is striking me is that the perception of ukuthi there will be a theory you will find in some linguistic textbook written in the global north that will help explain is obviously is not true, because right now you're telling us these narratives about the problems of borders, the problems of nationalism, and this idea ukuthi umXhosa who lives in Zimbabwe is no longer umXhosa, and bringing really to practical vision this idea that Africa and its borders don't make a lot of sense when you start to actually speak to abantu bas Africa to understand ukuthi somebody can be from both these disparate locales. And so I think this is it's really central ukuthi we do conduct grounded research. We do have ethnographies written ngesiXhosa, ngesiZulu, ngesiTswana, ngesiPedi, so that this kind of information can also be shared and not just simply translated, as it were. So this is really rich and really important work that you're doing.
Yes, and just to add on that, I think it's really important that we write our own stories, because I think there's a big difference when someone else comes and look at us and then go write about us, and rather than one of us giving us a chance to tell our own stories and present them as they are. Because there were a few, like one paragraph somewhere that would write about and say these were the Xhosa people who ran away from the Eastern Cape, or who were part of the pioneer column for St. John Rose because they were looking for jobs, or they were domestic workers and so on. And those stories are not true about these specific Xhosa people. Mm. Then they are there because they were written by other people writing about us. And there are so many stories that haven't been told about us. And I'm still waiting for more stories written by African people about as many. I think still research that needs to be done there, you know, find out what actually happened. So I think it's really important that as African academics do something about this. And I mean, especially if we want our African knowledge to be introduced more in the university level. And so it's really important.
Sure. I mean, I know you've just started, as you mentioned, at Saul Blakey. And I'm wondering, Nguti, what in your role at the institution, or maybe in your larger networks, how are you creating these bridges to connect? I hear that you're meeting with particular leadership, that you've met with people who are wanting to share their stories, but how are you building those networks and connections between people?
I've just moved from Grantstown to here. As I said, I've just been here for 2 months. And at the moment, I'm just collecting things and just putting things together. I haven't really decided on how I'm going to move forward with, you know, everything else. But the main thing, or personally, that I want to do to produce material in African languages, write academic articles in isiXhosa, present in conferences. Right now in June, we've got an Alasa International Conference happening at Rhodes, where I'll be presenting from the thesis in isiXhosa. Yes, I am having meetings with different people and all that, but I haven't decided exactly how to move forward. Because all I know is that I want to see material produced in our African languages. So I think I'll probably do whatever it takes to make sure that happens.
No, I think that's so key, because even in presenting in conferences and producing the materials and doing that central work of representation, you are taking the conversation forward. You are showing and not just only, you know, pontificating, Nguti, we should do African languages, but your work, the embodiment of this vision, which I think is absolutely fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, I said in one of my public lectures in conference that, you know, I feel like we've been discussing and having big meetings a lot, and there's been more discussions more than action. That's why I'm saying I feel like every university now should make sure that something is happening around the intellectualization of African languages. At Rhodes, I had a fantastic vice chancellor, Dr. Mabizela, who supported, you know, the intellectualization of African languages. And also here at Solpak, here I've got Professor Ms. Balim, who also supports the intellectualization of African languages. But I think it's also time for them as well to take it a step further and maybe look in every department and find out what is actually happening here. What are you doing, and how can we help? How can we make sure that something happening in the maths department, in the sciences, so that something actually happens, you know, about this? So let's now talk and let's do more as we talk, as we discuss around this, you know, decolonization of African languages. Because, I mean, this is 23 years after democracy at Rhodes, and only now you getting a first thesis written in isiXhosa. I think something has to happen. This isiXhosa thesis is not coming from maths or education or whatever department. It's coming from African languages department. In African languages department, you have people starting to be experts in African languages. And those people have been, for 113 years of Rhodes University, that have been producing material. They're learning to be these experts in these languages, but they cannot produce this material that they're producing in the languages that they want to be experts in. It's a bit shocking, you know, if you think about it, that you're learning to be an isiXhosa expert, but you cannot write in isiXhosa.
Yeah.
Only now we're celebrating a thesis from isiXhosa department, and we're the first one written in isiXhosa. I think we still have a long way to go. So we'll be even much more happier when you have a Xhosa thesis from Rhodes University coming from the education department, and later on coming from the maths department, and so on.
Mm.
And at Fulbright, written in Setswana, and from other faculties.
But
know,
we said we've
got hope.
We rightfully celebrate the milestone because, as I said, it does open up the doors and allow for that conversation to become a central part of the institution. So, because we are at the Academic Citizen trying to also encourage young academics and the people who want to expand their own knowledge and fields of understanding, I'm going to put you on the spot and ask you for just two isiXhosa novels that you would recommend that people who are interested in learning more about isiXhosa or even just reading a novel in an African language, what two would you recommend?
Zem Kinkomo Magwalandini by W.B. Khobusana. So that would be number one isiXhosa novel. And another one that I'm rereading it now, I think it is done, it's called... right here, Ubulumko Bezinja. So I'd recommend those two, and I'd say, you know, go read those two and see.
Zipinkomo, Ubulumko
Bezinja. That's an old novel, yeah, Zinkinkomo Magwalandini. I think it was first published in first edited in 1906, but it's still available, you can still get it, by Khobusana. And another one is Ubulumko Bezinja. The name of the author just ran out, but it's a novel full of satire, and I think it talks a lot to the situation that we've been in as black people, and also as, you know, and currently, you know, as we're talking about decolonization and so on. I think it does touch on those things. Ubulumko Bezinja, I think the guy is called Siyongwana.
Thank you so much. Okay. Zipinkomo Magwalandini, Ubulumko Bezinja.
Zimkinkomo Magwalandini by Khobusana and Ubulumko Bezinja by Siyongwana.
Brilliant. Thank you so much, Le. Really
all
appreciate
right.
your
okay.
time, and thank you for the amazing work.
Thanks.
And I look forward to that when we bump into each other, Echini, or maybe at Sobleki, we can all learn a bit more from your work.
Just so on the mentorship, you asked me something about the mentorship. I just wanted to also not necessarily about a physical individual that you speak to. I think, you know, authors and just reading books and people, you can have a mentor. For me, you know, I also look at people like Prof. Ngugi wa Thiong'o as my mentors. You know, I haven't really sat down with them, and just by interacting with their writings, I feel like they are doing quite an impact in my life. And on another one, yes, on, you know, just the thesis of the people of Zimbabwe. What I think is more significant about it is that it's a first at Rhodes University, named after a colonial oppressor called Cecil John Rhodes, and is the same man who displaced the Xhosa people from the Eastern Cape to Zimbabwe. So I think it makes it quite special that this business is not coming from UCT or Stellenbosch or another, but it's actually coming from Rhodes University, about Rhodes who displaced the Xhosa people. So I think that's fine, that quite special. And it's something I thought about it before I wrote the thesis, but it's something that I just, as I think now, it actually makes this quite a special thesis.
No, indeed, certainly. Thank you so much.
Hi, my name is Uzamaye Khapita. I'm an honors student from the Wits School of Journalism. So my thoughts on Dr. Kleze is that I think him writing thesis in Xhosa is an excellent initiative. I think it's incredibly inspiring, and it speaks to an example of transformation and decolonizing our curriculum and the ways in which we are learnt and taught to sort of approach academia, I think it speaks a lot to how it is important for us to use our own languages, and it's liberating and inspiring. Yeah.
The Academic Citizen is a podcast sponsored by ASAU, the Academic Staff Association of Wits University. ASAU is the union representing the interests of academic staff at Wits. For more information, visit www.asau.org.za. The Academic Citizen aims to be a platform for a diversity of views and opinions. We welcome your feedback, comments, and suggestions for future guests and shows. Email us at theacademiccitizen@gmail.com or leave a comment at www.theacademiccitizen.org. Research, scheduling, editing, and production was done by me, Simba Rashe Wondem. Jagger Melko created our jingles.